financial literacy, and the human condition. Welcome to Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Raham.
Welcome to Financial Fitness. I'm Jess Tyler, along with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Raham. Good morning.
Good morning, Jess. How are you?
I am good. What are we talking about today?
Have you ever heard the term synthetic ID?
No, but I'm assuming it's a fake ID?
Sort of. I think we're not really used to hearing it yet, but a synthetic ID is the kind of ID that scammers create, fraudsters create, out of bits and pieces of information. So you and I have talked about, in general, how to keep your credit safe and how to protect your identity a bit, but it's getting tougher and tougher and tougher the more digitally we move our money around, right? Mm-hmm. So, for instance, they might get somebody's social security number, somebody else's name, a third person's address. Maybe they make up some stuff in the middle, right? And they create an ID that is called a synthetic ID.
Okay.
And with that ID, they can open up accounts.
All right. How do you do that, though, without, I mean, you need to get like a license or like a passport originally, right?
Yeah. Have you ever seen the movies? In the movies where they get, you know, false papers?
Yes,
and then as soon as they get one piece. Yeah. As soon as they get one piece, they can get others, right? Think about this. What do you have to do to get your license? You have to bring some sort of proof of ID. But before you have a license, what do you provide?
Birth certificate.
Right? Yeah. Things that can be, unfortunately, can be recreated by fraudsters fairly easily. Mm-hmm. So the biggest target for this are young people, like babies or really, you know, toddlers, because they get a clean social security number. Mm-hmm. A fraudster will get a clean social security number, and they might have 15, 18, 20 years to use their credit before you discover there's a problem.
Right.
Right. Because your kid's not applying for loans.
Yeah. So you're not Nobody's thinking to go check your kid's social security numbers.
Exactly. Or their credit reports for that matter. They don't have any credit so you think. But it can happen that these things happen. Now, I'm not making something out of nothing here. Locally, we've had a pretty good scare lately. One of the local banks has a big banner on their, maybe more than one, has a big banner on their website that says, beware of people skimming cards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What that means is they go by your pocket. Your credit card is in your wallet or your debit card is in your wallet. They go by you close enough with a reader and they grab that information.
I mean, that's scary. How do you prevent that?
So one way to prevent it might be an RFID wallet, you know, one that protects it from radio frequencies. I used to hear that people would wrap them in aluminum foil.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that might work. I don't know. Some techie will call it and tell me whether that's crazy or not. But, you know, in the end, I think the people that are perpetrating these frauds are getting more and more clever. Mm-hmm. And while we are becoming more and more digitally savvy, we are always like behind the eight ball trying to make up for it. We come up with this great tool. Hey, here's going to be a great way that you can access all your accounts from home. And the next thing you know, we're saying, but somebody else has figured that out. And now we have to tell you a great way to protect that, mm-hmm. right? We're always putting in checks and balances. You see the spam software that you put on your computer, not just virus software, but adware. Right? Because you get these ads like, buy this product, and it's popping up on your computer and you don't know why. Well, sometimes those ads are, your computer has been infected by a virus. Click this link.
Right.
Now you click that link and all the information in your computer may be accessible to whoever is perpetrating that fraud. Now, it may also be some kid, you know, who loved it, or even an adult who just wanted to hack people for fun and drive you crazy. But in the last several months, I've had to help several people. I've been happy to help them, but wish there was a better thing to help them with. Several people who really were targeted by these things. One person was told at the bank that they have to clean their computer. Mm-hmm. They spent a lot of money going to somebody and having them clean the computer. They closed all their accounts down. They reopened accounts, blah, blah, all of this stuff. Only to find out probably that they actually weren't scammed. They were maybe almost scammed and they were scared and they lost a lot of sleep. And it's no surprise to any of us that it was somebody who was a bit elderly, right? Mm-hmm. Who was very worried about this and not as tech savvy as maybe Not that all elderly people aren't tech savvy. Hey, I just turned 60 and I'm pretty tech savvy,
you're not
right?
An elderly person, Frances.
Hey, if I'm lucky, I'll get there, you know? But truly, I mean, I know a lot of elderly people who are really great at tech.
Yeah.
So I don't mean to say that, but I think that there are a lot of people who are not good with tech, whether they're elderly or not. And those people fall prey to things like this when, you know, something pops up on your computer and it's very scary. Now, also, recently, I had somebody who did get their card skimmed locally, right in my own town. I know it. And they went to the bank and the people had been able to empty his checking account.
How quickly? Now,
quickly.
Yeah.
Quickly. He only had about $3,500 in there, but to him, that was a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And to many of us, it would be a lot of money, right? And somebody skimmed his card. It was his debit card. They set up a bunch of bill pays and other things where they could get the money out, transferred to other accounts. They emptied his account. He discovered it, of course. The bank called him or he went to the bank, one of the two, mm-hmm. and gee, there was no money in the account. And what the bank told him to do as a solution, now I have to give my hats off to this local bank who replaced his money.
Oh,
put
good.
All of his money back in the account.
Yeah.
So that was really nice. You know, a small local bank said, yep, we know it wasn't you. Here's your money back.
Yeah.
But they also said, we have to close the account, reopen a new account. And this was a person who put all their money in their checking account and then just paid their bills out of it. And the bank told him, open up a savings account as well. Put most of the money in the savings account and funnel what you need into the checking account. Mm-hmm. And in that way, if somebody accessed one of your accounts, they maybe couldn't get to both of them. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that was a real solution, but it was some advice and it helped him to feel more comfortable. I did tell him to lock down his credit reports as we always talk about, you know, to make sure that there's a freeze on your credit reports so that if somebody does start to take out loans or try to take out loans in your name, they can't get to your credit to get the loans approved. Mm-hmm. So let's say that somebody builds a synthetic ID like we were talking about, right? So they build a synthetic ID and it's got your social security number on it. Well, they go to get a loan. The first thing they're going to do is try to pull credit based on that social. Mm-hmm. If your credit reports have a freeze on them, they're not getting very far.
Right.
They can't get the loans. So I think that's really a valuable tool that I cannot stress enough, other than to say I wouldn't live a day of my life without a freeze on all three of my credit reports.
Little sidebar, how sad is it, though? Like the majority of us are good people going about our day, going about our business. And now we have to worry about, you know, going out to buy a special wallet or wrapping our stuff in aluminum foil because this could happen to anyone. I hate that.
Yeah, I hate it, too. I get very frustrated with exactly what you're talking about. Somebody who is just going along, trying to live their life, minding their own business, mm-hmm. and suddenly their hours, their time, their sleep gets hijacked by something like this when you would least expect it, of course. And at first you don't, you know, you think, oh, this can't be. There must be some mistake. I'll mm-hmm. call the bank, right? Or I'll call the credit card company. And then it starts to settle that, you know, somebody got your information. Now, that's like somebody breaking into your house. Most people report that they feel quite violated by that. Mm-hmm. And since you don't know who it was and you can't see who it wasn't like, hey, my brother had a problem with me and he came to my house and told me off. And I know how to deal with that. This is somebody you don't know. You don't know how they got in. Mm-hmm. You don't know whether people often think they got in through the banking system, but that's rare. Banking systems are pretty secure. It's rare, but it happens. Mm-hmm. We'll talk about SoFi a little bit. SoFi just agreed to pay $1.1 million in FINRA charges. FINRA is the independent organization that writes and enforces the rules for brokers and broker dealers. So for securities things. And they alleged that the firm their firm's cash management accounts, mm-hmm. the brokerage accounts, were vulnerable to fraud. And this is because they used a third party mm-hmm. and millions of dollars. And we can go into a little bit more detail about this in the second half, but millions of dollars, if mm-hmm. I didn't say that once already, were moved into fraudulent accounts. Accounts that were set up by the kinds of things we're talking about. Now, I think it was $8.6 million were moved before anybody noticed it. And $2.5 million of those dollars have already been gone. They're out of the account somewhere.
Yeah.
Right? So it gets caught somewhere and they stop. Now, those accounts may have been set up through the use of some sort of synthetic ID or fictitious identities. And they set up about 800 of these accounts before anybody caught anybody. Well, I don't even know if anybody has caught any of the perpetrators yet. But here's SoFi paying $1.1 million, and they just had to pay $700,000 for another offense, which was a separate FINRA offense, which was about allegedly poor oversight on their fully paid security lending accounts.
So these companies are being,
SoFi.
These companies, so some of these bigger companies are being held accountable then if they're not really vetting their third party vendor, and then the customer kind of gets the short end of that stick.
Well, I wish I knew more details about the SoFi case, because the first thing that irritated me about SoFi when I saw all their commercials on about, you know, you can get your student loans taken care of with SoFi, was that they were just refinancing them, right? They weren't really getting you out of that debt, and that they used SoFi, like socially, financially, you know, accountable or whatever. And, you know, I know they have this pattern of doing that, but people complain that they get lots of ads from SoFi trying to sell them other things. I don't see how this is socially great for people, right? But it really, you know, when you said, are they being held accountable? I wish I knew more about the details of this. I think it's newer. I mean, this happened in 2018 and 2019, but it's just coming to light now. They've just agreed to pay $1.1 million. But think about that for a minute. $8.6 million were transferred, out of 800 accounts. And SoFi has agreed to pay $1.1 million. Where's the rest of that money coming from?
Yeah. So is that just passed on to the customers that they just lost their money?
I mean, I'm hoping that there's insurance on that, but I don't know. I haven't been able to dig up those details. I don't know. I doubt that these were FDIC insured accounts. These are brokerage accounts.
Yeah.
Right? So I don't know if they have insurance for that. But even if we just take how much money was transferred out of those accounts was $2.5 million. This is less than half of that.
Yeah, that's a pretty light fine then when you look at how much is gone.
Yeah. So are they accountable? I don't know. I mean, they're big. How accountable are they? $700,000 in fines for poorly overseeing some fully, you know, funded security lending accounts. Is that accountable? I don't know. They, you know, one would like to believe that, but I do want to talk in the second half about this too, because really we should talk about the kinds of things that happen, like how they got the money out of these accounts and how nobody noticed this and why a third party company. How this happened? Why didn't these accounts get triggered?
Right.
Why, you know, at your local bank, most of the time, right? And somebody, and here's a plug for local banks, right? Even though I use distance banks and local banks. When somebody is making a transaction, it may even be you. I don't know about you, but I get a call from the bank, or I get a letter or something that says, are you trying to do this? Or they lock down your card.
It happens almost every time when you're on vacation. It happens to me all the time on vacation.
It does. Do you have a story about that?
Where I just, when you last time we went to Florida, I was in there, I was in the shoe store buying some shoes, and then all of a sudden it blocked me so the transaction wouldn't go through. And then I got like a message on my phone and I'm thinking, oh, they know I'm shoe shopping. How is this happening? But it was just because the purchase was from Florida and not from Massachusetts. Yes. So they were making sure it was really me, which I appreciate.
Absolutely. But do you know how to prevent that?
Probably call them ahead of time and tell them you're going on vacation. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. But however, I did that once, and then I went to Canada and I got there very late. I was very tired. I was just trying to check into the hotel, and guess what? My card wouldn't work.
Yeah.
Couldn't work. And we tried to get them on the phone. It was like an hour. And finally, the hotel took pity on me and they said, you seem like an honest person. We're just going to give you a room and straighten this out in the morning. And they really did. They really did.
Good.
Hats off to Guelph, Canada, who did that for me. So, yeah.
All right. Well, we've got more in the second half, but I do want to get your phone number.
Sure. It's 413-773-3333.
And you can visit hugyourmoney.com. We'll be back with part two, Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Frances Ram on WHMP.
Every day, financial ads claiming to be different from the competition. Are they? I'm Frances Ram, the Money Doctor, and I'm about to make a bold statement. I believe the thing to focus on isn't their uniqueness, it's yours. No one has the same financial situation or needs as you, and no one can help us help you better than you. But the truth is, when it comes to managing money, most of us are not as successful as we'd like to be. No matter how focused we are, it's almost impossible to separate emotion, and being in a relationship can further compound the issue. That's why I developed Hug Your Money. Financial coaching coupled with online software and tools to empower you to manage money wisely. We guide you every step of the way to resolve immediate issues and plan for your financial future with modeling scenarios. So whether it's debt, budget, retirement planning, or a financial crisis, having a Hug coach in your corner is like having a new best financial friend. Hug Your Money is as unique as you are. In fact, it's patented. Visit HugYourMoney.com.
Welcome back to Financial Fitness. I'm Jess Tyler, along with the money doctor, Dr. Francis Ram. Hi.
Hi. So while we were off the air, you mentioned that you got an email, some sort of an email that has to do with what we're talking about.
Yeah, it's so interesting that this happens because I didn't know what the topic was ahead of time. And I just saw this morning and I'm like, oh, what is this? As a lot of people do, I've gone to Credit Karma before. So now I get notifications all the time from them. And it said, just a reminder, Jessica, it looks like your personal data may have been compromised. Not at Credit Karma, but in at least one data breach affecting another company. So, of course, I see that and I'm like, oh, no. Like, where do you even go from there?
Does it tell you what to do? Or does it just say, warning, it may have been breached?
Well, I'll click on it while we're talking right now. It says click here to see what the breach was.
Okay. So while you're looking that up, I will say that if it's specific and it says, so in order to rectify the situation, you must go here and click these things and we're going to give you free identity theft protection, then it's probably legit. But still, I would go directly to the source. I wouldn't click any links.
After I've clicked three links. But okay, so the data breach says 2021 AT&T subscriber data reported March of 2024. So yeah, I do remember that article about the big AT&T breach.
So that's legit, I think.
Yeah.
So what are you going to do about it?
Freeze my credit report.
Yes, Yay! You are. You're going to freeze your credit reports. That's right. I think I should give out that number. I think it's 800-685-1111. I'm going by memory here. You can push some buttons on your phone and put a freeze on your credit report. And you could, they typically will tell Experian and TransUnion, mm-hmm. but if they're not doing that any longer, you'll hear it in the recording. So just follow the prompts. It will ask you, do you want to put a fraud alert on or a freeze? I would recommend a freeze if you're trying to keep your credit safe like that. It doesn't cost you anything to do. You can pull your credit reports at annualcreditreport.com for free and look at all three of them and make sure they're okay.
The only question that I had on that, and I know we talked about that before, about, you know, putting the freeze on there, while it does keep you safe, thinking about like all the people, and myself included, that have auto pays and everything.
You're not freezing your credit card, you're freezing your credit report.
Okay, explain the difference here.
It won't affect your auto pays at all.
Okay.
Your auto pays are set up through either the company that's drafting the money from your account or through your bank as an online bill pay, right? Mm-hmm. So that's, you're generating that. That has nothing to do with pulling your credit.
Okay.
The freeze on your credit reports is so that nobody can get credit in your name.
Okay.
Now, where it might seem fuzzy is where it might seem connected to a credit card is, let's say you go to a big box store and they say, if you want our loyalty credit card right now, you can get a 20% discount. And you say, okay, I'll apply. You won't get it instantly unless you unlock your credit report, because they can't get to your credit report.
Okay, got it. So good or bad, no one can report anything.
Nobody can get credit in your name.
Okay.
The credit cards, the lenders are still able to report. The information still goes in, but nobody can pull it out.
Okay, got it.
In order to get a loan in your name. So it's good that you asked that, because I just always rip that off, like put a freeze on your credit report and I don't really think about the details, but that's what it is. It just stops people from obtaining debt in your name.
Yeah, I think I was just
getting get your credit report.
I think I was just getting confused with credit report and credit card. So you're putting a freeze on the report, not the card itself. So if somebody stole your credit card, they then could still use it.
That's another story. If you're missing your credit card, then you absolutely want to call the credit card company, lock that card down, get a new card, new number. And here's a tip, because I've had to do it. You know, I use credit cards, but I just don't pay any interest on them, right? I rack up points and then I exchange them for cash and I make the credit card companies pay me, which is always kind of fun.
Yeah.
So, word to the wise, don't do this unless you can absolutely afford to pay your card in cash every month without problems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Once you get to that point, you can use this to your advantage. But sometimes you have a lot of auto pays going against that card.
Right.
And it's a real pain in the patoot, if you will, to have to redo those. So what I have suggested to people is take an old statement that shows the charges that were set up as auto pay, mm-hmm. or ask the company when you're getting a new card, could you please send me the records of who I have auto drafting so that I can set these up again? Most credit card companies will tell you those auto drafts will probably go through okay, mm-hmm. but they don't always. So you really want to pay attention to that. For
okay.
sure. Yeah.
Yeah. I know that I've found before too, like you're always hesitant to cancel it right away because you're thinking maybe I'm just being absent-minded and I'll find it at the end of the day. But so much damage could be done in that amount of time.
And it's so easy to resist it. If you use it for a lot of things or if you're like me and you're a numbers person, I know my credit card number by heart, mm-hmm. right? I know everything about it by heart. If I lost the card, I might not even notice it right away because I hardly ever pull the card out to use it.
Right.
Right. Everything's Apple Pay or your mind, or it's you've saved the number in on the internet somewhere. But that's just the point, is the more digitally exposed we are, mm-hmm. the more mm-hmm. things like this SoFi problem can happen. And what happened with them is, okay, so they hired a third-party company. Third-party company was supposed to decide if when you applied for this account, you were a real person, it was legit, you should be given the account, mm-hmm. et cetera. For whatever reason, the third-party company had some tools in place where they would sort of assign a score, if you will, right, to your, not a credit score, but they would say, okay, Jess, we've got your information. You reached this score. Okay, you fit in the box. Your account will now be, and this was supposed to be used in combination with some other tools that SoFi had.
Okay.
But if you cleared that hurdle, mm-hmm. your account was automatically approved.
Okay.
If you didn't clear that hurdle, it was supposed to trigger a manual review of your account. Okay.
And what did it trigger?
Of your application.
Instead?
Well, it was supposed to trigger a manual review of your application. Unfortunately, even when that was supposed to happen, mm-hmm. apparently it didn't always happen. And so accounts were set up with false social security numbers, wrong telephone numbers, residential addresses. Even some accounts that provided the same address as an account that was already open.
Ooh.
But somehow it didn't get a red flag to the tune of 800 accounts. Mm-hmm. Now, out of those 800 accounts, so let me see if I can paint this picture. Somebody creates a false account mm-hmm. through a mm-hmm. synthetic ID or other means, but they apply to SoFi for this account. And this could, I'm not picking on SoFi. This could be any company. It just happens that SoFi just got, you know, just agreed to pay this fine. So they get an account, they open it up. Now they can use that account to transfer funds from someplace else into that account, mm-hmm. right? But there's no real person behind it. So somebody's behind the curtains pulling the strings, right? So they transfer funds from another account. Maybe it's another one of your accounts with your same social security number, and they've used it to set this up. Mm-hmm. You know how you can link your accounts together?
Yeah.
Okay. So now they transfer money from one of your other accounts or from somebody's account. Could be somebody else's account. As long as they can transfer in, they don't care where it comes from.
Right.
And they transfer money from that account into the SoFi account that the real person doesn't own. Mm. But then they have the ability to transfer out of that false SoFi account somewhere else. Might be the Cayman Islands,
right.
Might be St. Kitts, might be Sweden, might be Turner's Falls. You don't know.
And that's
right?
Where the 8.6 million went?
That's where the 8.6 million went into these 800 accounts.
Mm-hmm.
Somewhere somebody stopped it, but only after 2.5 million had transferred out, had been withdrawn into other accounts. So 2.5 million is gone somewhere.
We don't know where. I wonder if they had, you know, they didn't have any people like overlooking it. It was just like all manual, like automatic determine the number, automatic, you know, letter that goes out.
Yeah.
And then they have like one supervisor to go through, you know, hundreds of these. I wonder if it's something like that where they have less people and more machines.
You know, that's an interesting question because we come from a time, you know, we all remember a time. Most of us remember a time where things were done in person. In fact, things are still often done in person. Mm-hmm. You want a mortgage? Sometimes people are doing it through GMAC or someplace online, right? But most often people show up at a local bank and say, I need a mortgage.
Right.
And a mortgage lender sits across the table from you, verifies your identity. Heck, I have to verify identities in my business all the time. Somebody new comes to me, anti-money laundering, right, is a problem. I have to take anti-money laundering courses all the time to be able to keep my license fresh to sell products. And what I have to do is to answer all those questions correctly. An anti-money laundering course teaches you things like, you know, okay, I'll give you some examples. Somebody comes into your office and they want to buy a big life insurance policy and they just want to pay for it in cash. Is that a problem? Yeah, it's a problem. Now, you might get to a point eventually after asking enough questions that you could document enough stuff to do this. But I would never do that. I would never take cash for a life insurance policy. Because what's happening is they're probably trying to wash money from someplace. Mm-hmm. If not, they can deposit it into their account and write a check against it, right? Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of this stuff where people, anti-money laundering is that people try to place the money into an account. They'll try to layer it, many different accounts. You can't, local politicians, big politicians get accused of doing this all the time. They have so many corporations set up, so many bank accounts, so many things in their tax returns that you can't sort out where the money ever came from. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. That's a worry for money laundering. And when we're talking about, you know, would it have been better if somebody in person looked at these accounts? Perhaps to some extent, it would be better that somebody might have seen, for instance, a duplicate account being opened with the same social security number, and a human might have said, hey, does this look right to you? Maybe we transposed a number. This, we better check into this.
Yeah.
A human might have said, wait a minute, what do you mean you want to open an account with us, but your address is in, I don't know, Vietnam? Okay, maybe they would have said, I think we want to check into this further. Let's verify that this is a real person.
Right.
Because that's what this all comes down to. If they couldn't verify that it was a real person, mm-hmm. for instance, let's suppose this third-party company thing really worked and everything got red flagged that should have. Mm-hmm. Okay, that would have been easy enough to say, send us a copy of your license. Let's get into a Zoom. I want to see you hold up your license next to your face. Is this really you? Yeah. Okay, if not, they went running, mm-hmm. right? That's what people do. If you can prove it's you, it's no problem. Like, yeah, here's my license. Thanks for calling me. I love that you kept me safe. No problem.
Yeah.
But if you're the shyster, not so much.
Yeah, they probably target a bunch of different corporations and some ask questions and some just don't. So they get where they get it.
Well, I think you're right. I think if a human had been overseeing all of this, there might have been some instances. Mm-hmm. But once a company or once a criminal knows, I'm calling them fraudsters, let's just cut to the chase and call them criminals, right?
Yeah.
Once a criminal knows that they can break your system, mm-hmm. that they can mm-hmm. manipulate the numbers so it doesn't red flag that application, all they have to do is this, this, and this, and their app gets through. Once they get one through, they're going to go.
Yeah.
800 apps before they get stopped. Mm-hmm. And I still don't know who has done this. I just know that SoFi has said, we'll pay $1 million because it's on us. We had a third party organization, even with our tools, it didn't work right. Let's just settle this so we can keep doing business. And they pay FINRA $1.1 million. Yeah.
Wow. All right. Well, we are out of time, but I want to get your phone number.
413-885-8888.
And you can go to hugyourmoney.com. All right. Thank you so much. We'll be back again next Saturday right here with Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Frances Ram on WHMP.
Have you heard about Get the Tea? It's an online herbal supplement company with high quality standards. You cannot find these in stores. They carry cleansing teas and targeted herbal supplements for all your health needs. Go to GetTheTea.com today to order yours. Health shouldn't be put off. It should be a priority. And check out their specials page for sale items. That's GetTheTea.com. Enter code TEA123 for 10% off exclusively for my listeners. GetTheTea.com, code TEA123. Order today. This is Frances Rayum, the Money Doctor. Now you can become 100% debt-free, budget successfully, and retire well, all under the Hug Your Money umbrella.
I would say that if we hadn't taken this path, we would probably be exactly where we were before we started with Hug Your Money. I'm going to take at least a month off, and we're just going to chill, I guess, if that's what you call it.
I've got a little list. I mean, I can see him doing things that he talked about over the years, but never has time to do.
My name is Bill.
I'm Jill.
And I'm going to retire in May of this year, finally. It's all about Hug Your Money and Hug Your Budget for us.
Debt, budget, retirement. Hug works best when we work together. Schedule your free consultation with a Hug Your Money coach today. Visit hugyourmoney.com. Hug Your Money. So unique, it's patented.
Financial Literacy and the Human Condition. Welcome to Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Raham.
Welcome to Financial Fitness. I'm Jess Tyler, along with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Raham. Good morning.
Good morning, Jess. How are you?
I'm good. I'm looking forward to this show because it's our question show.
So I'm looking forward to these questions.
All right. Let's start off with David. He, and this is kind of a general question. He wants to know, what is the best long-term investment?
David, wow. Okay. Well, let me just pick one. So you know what I'm going to say. It would be better for me if I knew anything more about David, how old he is, what his goals are, all of that. Best is a relative term. The best long-term investment for one person may not be for another.
Maybe we could break it down to like if you were in your 20s and 30s versus if you're in your 40s and 50s.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Is I hate to, you know, give these sort of double talk answers when I'm really trying to give you information. So with my disclaimer that this is not investment advice, since I don't really know anything about David, I'll give you some general parameters. Long-term investments in general, when you say the best long-term investment, if he's young, he may be thinking about, you know, I can tolerate some risk. So would my best long-term investment be stocks? Would it be mutual funds? So if he's very young, he might be able to tolerate some risk, you know, 20s to 30s, that sort of age group can certainly tolerate some risk. Doesn't mean you have to take it, right? But it means you can tolerate it. In other words, you can maybe invest in a well-diversified stock portfolio or a group of mutual funds, which by their very nature are already diversified. If you don't know what a mutual fund is, if you think, well, it's a Fidelity mutual fund, that means I own Fidelity stock. No, it means that Fidelity has put a bunch of things together, or a John Hancock, or anybody that does a mutual fund has put a bunch of different kinds of investments in the fund so that they are automatically diversifying that. And mutual funds are run by a fund manager who usually takes a cut of what his assets or her assets are under management. So if they do well, they make more money. If they don't do well, they make less. Now, you might say, well, that sounds great. You know, they've got skin in the game. I'm going there. But a mutual fund manager really doesn't care much about your $10,000 in general. Maybe some do, but, you know, they care about the overall portfolio for which they're taking a cut, sometimes a quarter of a percent, sometimes more. And the fund may charge you, you know, a 1% fee or 1.5% management fee, something like that. There are no-load mutual funds also that don't have those kinds of fees, but are way too detailed to get into right now. But for a long-term investment for somebody in their 20s or 30s, stocks, mutual funds, things of that nature may be good. Real estate might be good. If you have time to sit on it until another time when the market is better or the increase in the asset is higher and then execute a sale, then you can handle a long-term investment. If you're in your 40s or 50s, your long-term investment might be something more like an annuity or a CD or, you know, bonds or something that's a little more conservative mixed with some of those other things we talked about. And if you're at retirement age, then although you may have enough money to tolerate some losses in a stock or a mutual fund portfolio, that's a time when you might want to shift more toward something like annuities, CDs, bonds, whatever might be fairly safe in the market at that time. We talk a lot about fixed index annuities because they're a fixed product. In other words, they have guarantees, but they still have earnings linked to the market. So you don't have the downside potential that you would have with a mutual fund or stock portfolio, but you have some upside potential that can be very competitive.
Okay.
So I hope that gives him some answer.
Okay. Well, the next one you kind of touched on this one. This is from Erica in Northampton. What is the difference between an annuity and a CD? And I got this a couple times.
I just want to take this moment to say to people, I don't know these questions in advance. My favorite thing about these shows is that I never know the questions. I don't even know the categories of the questions. You just collect them. If anybody wants to write in with a question, jtyler@whmp.com. And then you spring them on me. And I love it. It's like one of my favorite things to do.
Well, what's so funny, too, is that when I get the questions, I try to answer them in my head to see if I'm anywhere close. And I've got about a 25% win rate.
All right. You're doing pretty well. The difference between a CD and an annuity. Okay. So first of all, lots of different kinds of CDs and lots of different kinds of annuities. But in general terms, the word annuity comes from the word annual. So it's designed at some point to give you some kind of annual income. Doesn't mean you have to take income from it. You might just draw interest, or you might take your RMDs, required minimum distributions, if it's an IRA. You might make withdrawals. You might take the whole thing out at once when it's past a surrender charge period. But there are some things they have in common. So a CD and an annuity will both probably have some kind of surrender charge. Now, they may be called a penalty or a fee, but what that means is if you take the money out early, before the contract is matured, whether it's a CD or an annuity, you're probably going to suffer some kind of a penalty.
Okay.
An annuity will usually have something called a free withdrawal clause on it. So maybe per year, they're all different, but maybe per year you could take, let's say, 10% of your balance out without a penalty. You only pay the penalty on anything over that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. An annuity by its very nature is tax deferred. A CD is not, unless it's an IRA. So one of the main differences between an annuity, there are lots, but one of the main differences between an annuity and a CD is that enjoyment of tax deferral, whether you want it or you don't, right? If you don't want your tax deferral, if you don't care, you don't mind paying taxes on your money as you earn it, a CD might be the right thing for you if it's a good fit.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to grow your money as if it were an IRA, even if it's not, then you could use an annuity to do that because while the money is in there growing, there's no tax on it. So instead of earning a dollar and sending 30 cents to the government, you get to make money on the whole dollar, which is the power of tax deferral. That's why people do IRAs. But you can't just create an IRA with, let's say, $100,000 from the sale of your house. There are rules against that.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want tax deferral on that money, an annuity might be a way to do it. Now, a CD is often designed, most CDs are pretty simple. You put the money in the bank, they pay you a certain interest rate for a period of time, done deal, like a high yield savings account would be, with the exception of an early withdrawal penalty or fee. An annuity, you can put lots of different kinds of riders on. For instance, you could put an income rider on it, depending on the product. And that might mean that at some point in the future, you can draw a lifetime income, an income that you can't outlive, regardless of what the market does. Some annuities have bonuses up front, you know, 10, 15, 20, 30% bonus right up front on the contract. They might have other kinds of riders, like something called a first die rider. If either spouse dies, you can get out of the contract instantly without any surrender charges. I could go on and on and on. One of the main differences can be that an annuity avoids probate automatically. Whoever the beneficiaries are on the annuity, get the money regardless of what your will says.
Okay.
You can do something similar to that in a CD with beneficiaries, but many people never put beneficiaries on their CDs.
Going back to the tax deferral thing real quick, it seems like if you do the math, if you're doing the tax deferral and that full amount of money is growing each time, what is the benefit of not doing tax deferral? Because some people obviously must do that. Why would you want to pay the taxes now and have less money grow? Does that make sense?
It makes sense. I think that's the same argument as do you Roth your IRA or do you not? Do you pay the taxes now or later?
Mm-hmm.
And I think the simplistic answer is, well, I'm going to pay the taxes sooner or later anyway. Why not pay them now? Or people will say, well, I'm going to be in a higher tax bracket later on, so I want to pay them now. If your taxes are going up, you know, that's what taxes do. They go up. You have to remember that you may be at retirement not in a higher tax bracket. You might be in a lower tax bracket.
Mm-hmm.
So the answer is one of, you know, accounting, really. For most people, I think the enjoyment of tax deferral can be a great thing. Now, you could also have an annuity that's a Roth IRA, you know. So there's so many different kinds. There are fixed annuities. There are fixed indexed annuities. There are variable annuities.
Mm-hmm.
The list goes on and on. The one that I will say I use only very, very sparingly and only in the case of an emergency is something called an immediate annuity. And that's the kind people seem to know the most about, where you just dump your money in and it gives you an annual stream of income and that's it. You've given up control of the money for the income. I would not recommend using that unless there's some urgent reason it has to be done.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, I would rather let the money grow and take it out when you need it.
Would you say that one of them, a CD or an annuity, is better for a small sum and one's better for a large sum, or would you not break it down that way?
That's a good question. So many annuities, it's a very good question. Many annuities have a minimum deposit of, some have 5,000, but most of them have 10,000 or 25,000 minimum. So if you're somebody who's investing a few thousand dollars, then a CD might be just what you need. Also, if you need short-term liquidity, like let's say you only want to tie this money up for 6 months or a year, then a CD is a much better deal for you than most annuities, which have longer term. So as Dave asked, what's the best long-term investment? An annuity might be one of them, depending on your needs. Yeah.
Okay. We're going to get to some more questions coming up. And I want to get your phone number, though, because like you said, a lot of these questions you can generally answer, but you need some specifics to give the best advice.
Absolutely. They can reach us at 413-773-3333. 33.
Or you can visit hugyourmoney.com. We'll be right back with part two of Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Frances Ram, coming up on WHMP.
Every day, financial ads claiming to be different from the competition. Are they? I'm Frances Ram, the Money Doctor, and I'm about to make a bold statement. I believe the thing to focus on isn't their uniqueness, it's yours. No one has the same financial situation or needs as you, and no one can help us help you better than you. But the truth is, when it comes to managing money, most of us are not as successful as we'd like to be. No matter how focused we are, it's almost impossible to separate emotion, and being in a relationship can further compound the issue. That's why I developed Hug Your Money. Financial coaching coupled with online software and tools to empower you to manage money wisely. We guide you every step of the way to resolve immediate issues and plan for your financial future with modeling scenarios. So whether it's debt, budget, retirement planning, or a financial crisis, having a Hug coach in your corner is like having a new best financial friend. Hug Your Money is as unique as you are. In fact, it's patented. Visit hugyourmoney.com.
Welcome back to Financial Fitness. I'm Jess Tyler, along with the Money Doctor, Dr. Frances Ram, on one of our favorite shows. We're answering listener questions.
We are. And so Dave and Erica will both be getting a copy of the book for writing in with questions that we used on the air. So I appreciate that. And of course, I would extend to them the offer to just call me. I'll be happy to answer them more specifically. I love these shows because I never know what the questions are. And they're varied. And sometimes they involve, you know, relationships. I don't know if we have any of those questions today, but sometimes they're things like, you know, I racked up a bunch of debt and my spouse doesn't know. Mm-hmm. How do I tell them?
Yeah. All right. The next one comes from Sam in East Hampton. What are the biggest mistakes people make when investing in the stock market?
Ooh. Okay. Number one, not watching their money.
Okay.
Not watching their money. The average person invests in the stock market, usually through a broker, but even on their own, and they watch it for a little while closely, and they see it go up and down, and they get nervous, and they get happy, and all of that. But then other things take over, and they just don't log in, or they say, I got a person who watches that for me, so I don't worry about it.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say that's the number one thing, is to not look at it. I would say second would be to not diversify. People tend to fall in love with a stock, which is going to be number three, by the way. So people tend to fall in love with a stock, and they say, I want Disney because I know Disney, and Disney's always great.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say that's a big mistake, to not get a diversified portfolio that includes a number of different kinds of stocks. In other words, don't buy all tech stocks. Don't buy all oil stocks, right?
Mm-hmm.
Diversify. When the market is going up in one sector and down in another, then you can benefit from that. And I should mention, I'm not a stockbroker. So this is about the mistakes I see people make. Number three, maybe should have been the first one, but is getting emotionally attached to your stock.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you think, oh, I love this stock. I have great faith in this company, and this company's going places. And, you know, no matter whether it's sinking or swimming, you're just happy to own that stock. Be careful about that. Some of these things are worse when you're a short-term investor than they are when you're a long-term investor.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the long-term things that you can tolerate, that you can't really tolerate well as a short-term stock investor, is having an exit strategy. If you're trading short-term or buying stocks for the relatively short-term, let's say a year or less, maybe even 2 years or less, and you don't have a stop loss or a real exit strategy where you say, okay, if this goes in the other direction, I'm cutting my losses at $26.09 or whatever. You need to be very specific when you get in my opinion, to how you're getting out. Otherwise, what happens is people just hang on for the ride month after month, week after week, waiting for this stock to come back because the market always comes back, blah, blah, blah. And sometimes those stocks go, sometimes they become penniless or penny stocks, I mean. So I think you have to watch all of those things. Maybe not looking for the right advisor, just like haphazardly somebody comes to you and says, I've got some stock to invest in, you know, give me some money and I'll invest it. That wouldn't be how I would invest. I'd go and find a good broker who has a good reputation, get some referrals, give them a small amount of money, see how they do, stay in touch with them. But I'll tell you this one golden rule. No one will watch your money like you will.
Yeah, how true.
I don't care how nice they are. I just don't care. I mean, they're busy, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of the brokers have sort of these, you know, check the box. Okay, here's the portfolio we give, and it's sort of cookie cutter, and we give it to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's how they manage a book, because they can't manage, you know, 500 people individually. So I hope those are some of the biggest mistakes people make when they're investing in the stock market. I hope some of that is helpful.
Would you say that, Sam, when you were talking about checking it often, how much is enough and how much is obsessive? Like once a day, once a week, once a month?
Depends on the stocks.
Okay.
If you're really day trading or you're really looking at things, you might even be trading before the market opens or after the market closes and be done. If you're trading, you know, longer term, you might want to look at it, you know, once a week, once a month, once a quarter. Some people will check it every day just to get a feel. I think that's a good idea, is to learn how the stock moves. Is it moving in a channel? Is it, you know, does it spike up or down? What causes it to move, so that you can be a more informed investor?
Mm-hmm.
You know, gee, when gas price is up, my stock is down.
Yeah.
I should pay attention to that. Next time I see gas prices up, I should maybe check my stock, right? Those kinds of things are very, very valuable. Know what you own.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Next question. We've got this one from Lisa in Williamsburg. I've saved $1,000. Where is the best place to put it?
Good job, Lisa. Good job. I wish I knew how old she was, but I don't care. I'm just happy that she's saving.
Mm-hmm.
So saving $1,000, depending on what she needs it for, and I'm going to guess that this should be emergency cash reserves and she's going to continue to save.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times people will save for something. So they'll say, I'm saving it for a car or whatever, but then they don't build an emergency cash reserve.
Right.
And they end up in credit card debt because they overextended themselves. So the first thing she should do, I think, is to earmark that for emergency cash reserves and continue to save until she has whatever she considers to be a healthy emergency cash reserve. I don't abide by the you must have, you know, 6 month savings, 3 month savings,
mm-hmm.
Bill pay, because people can tolerate different amounts of risk. But once she's got that, or even now, a good place to put it where she would have high liquidity and still decent earnings is probably a high yield savings account or a money market account. And in this market, I just opened one for 5.55%. So you can do pretty well for short-term liquidity, money okay. that you want to be liquid.
So don't just leave it in your
savings
account.
Just leave it in. Well, not unless your bank is paying you a good rate of interest.
Okay.
Now, you know, getting 4.5 at your local bank that you know and you're happy with, where you can, it's very convenient to move the money, might be worth that rather than getting 5.5 someplace that you don't know, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, yeah, I think she should just ask her local bank to begin with, hey, how can I make more money on this? But I would not say mutual funds or anything yet. If she doesn't have cash reserves, if all she's saved is $1,000, I want her to keep working on that and keep it safe, but try to earn some money on it. At the point where she gets past emergency reserves,
mm-hmm.
and now she's starting to save money that she wants to invest, let's just say, for the sake of argument, she has to have $5,000 in emergency reserves. I don't know.
Okay.
When she gets past that, let's say she builds up another $4,000 or $5,000 or $10,000. That's a time to start looking for where can I actually, I would say, invest it, meaning something other than a savings. Where can I make more money on it? How can I protect it? How can I grow it further?
Okay. Yeah. My answer was under the mattress, so that's not a good spot.
Well, no. But, you know, it brings up a point. Sometimes people will keep cash in their safe at home.
Mm-hmm.
And this might sound silly but a little paranoid, but if you're going to put your cash in your safe, do me a favor, please put it in a Ziploc bag and then put it in the safe, because if you have a fire, and I know you've heard me say this before, if you have a fire and they come and douse your house with water,
mm-hmm.
the fire may not have bothered your money, but the water will.
Got it.
So if you really must put your money in a safe, please put it in a Ziploc bag. But yes, I would prefer that it's not under the mattress or in your safe. Yes.
I will say, not getting into a big thing about, you know, what is going on in the world today, but are you finding that a lot more people are keeping money at home? Like, I know two separate people that said they've got their money at home because if anything happens with the banks or online or any kind of a cyber attack, are you seeing any more of that in your business?
No, I'm not. People aren't telling me that necessarily.
So I just have crazy
but
friends.
But I do. No, I'm not crazy friends at all. I mean, I think a lot of people keep some cash on hand for a number of reasons. What if the banks are closed, if the ATM doesn't work, if you want to buy something in cash that is a big ticket item, if you don't want a paperwork trail on it, there's a whole bunch of reasons that people keep cash on hand. But I would just say that making decisions out of fear is not necessarily great. So maybe this is a short-term decision for people and they're waiting till November to find out what happens. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But this is a fear that's been going on since digital stuff was popular. You know, you used to go to the bank and get your money and the people actually handed it to you. And, you know, it wasn't really there, but they had enough money on hand to make it seem like the money was always there. And I think people are more nervous about not being able to electronically transfer or get money out. But you have to remember things like if we really had a cyber attack, mm-hmm. your gas pumps aren't working. Nothing's working. So I don't know what your cash is doing for you at that point, except if it really gets ugly, I guess then you can trade cash for other things. But boy, that's a world I'm not looking forward to if that ever happens. Yeah.
Okay. By the way, we are answering listener questions. If there is a question that you want, we're going to be doing more of these shows in the future. So you can send it in to info@hugyourmoney.com or to me here at jtyler@whmp.com. And if we use the question in the show, you're going to get a copy of the book, which is right behind you.
Oh, Retire Debt and Retire Well. It is. Yeah.
And I believe
retire sooner, live better.
Perfect. All right. Excellent. Next question is, what is my maximum debt to income ratio I can have to still qualify for a mortgage?
Oh, I like it. Who is this from?
This is from Jim, and this is from Southampton.
Great. Oh, so a little bit will depend on the bank, whether you're working with a mortgage broker or a local bank or a big box bank. But in general, I like to see it at 36% or less, which is what the banks always used to go by. Right. They used to say 36%. Let's define that for people. Your debt to income ratio is your monthly payments in debt against your gross income. And so people get that confused quite a bit. That's your income before taxes and deductions.
Okay.
So if you have $100,000 a year coming in before taxes and deductions, mm-hmm. let's say you have a $100,000 salary, you can be paying no more than $36,000 out in monthly payments.
Okay.
Right. Over the course of the year.
Okay.
Over the course of the year. So $3,000 a month, mm-hmm. right?
I'm doing fast math in my head here as you're saying it.
$100,000 salary, $3,000 a month in debt payments would put you at a 36% debt to income ratio. I like that ratio. I like to see less than that. It's from experience of working with clients for the last 15 years, watching when they can pay their debts and still tolerate a surprise car expense and when they can't manage to buy popcorn to go to the movies. So 36% or less, I like. However, as home prices have become more expensive mm-hmm. and credit cards have eaten up more of people's salary and childcare and everything else has gone up, banks have had to become a little more aggressive about lending for mortgages. And so most banks now will lend at 42, even 43% debt to income ratio.
Okay.
So I don't love that. I know it will get you into a home and I know you'll be okay for a while, but I also know that at that level, money is tight mm-hmm. and you will not be able to tolerate surprise expenses. They will end up on credit cards. Credit cards will give you credit at, 50, 55, 60% debt to income ratio. They don't care. They're getting 29% until you default. So try not to let yourself get buried. So to qualify for a mortgage, yes, you could probably even have 42 or 43%. To be able to pay it and live a decent lifestyle, I would like you to have no more than 36% debt to income ratio.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I think we have time for one more question. This one is from Betty in Amherst, and it's kind of on the similar housing question, I would say. She says, is it smart to keep renting with the price of houses right now, or am I just throwing money away every month?
Oh, that's a hard one. Yeah, short term, you can look at it and say, no, it's not, rent is really high, but so are house prices, and I should trade in my rent for a house price. But where I think you might win the game is when house prices start to go down. Because your rent isn't going down with them. So when house prices start to go down, not unless you got some unusual landlord who said, my house is worth less money now, so I'll charge you less rent. But I've never seen that happen. Mm-hmm. So at the time when houses become more affordable, because you have to remember that renting is a short-term financial obligation and buying a house is a long-term financial obligation. Mm-hmm. So to clarify this a little bit, if you're trading in $2,000 a month in rent for $2,000 a month in a mortgage, that might seem logical right now. Oh, I'll build equity and all of that. But you are saddling yourself with that $2,000 a month in a mortgage on a long-term investment whose value may decline. Mm-hmm. Now, everybody thinks real estate always goes up. In general, it's on an upward trajectory, but that doesn't mean it's always up. So let's say that you trade that in. Okay, let's give you a scenario on both sides. You're renting for $2,000 a month. Something happens and you can't afford your rent any longer. What do?
You move out.
Yeah, you find a less expensive apartment. You move home with your family, whatever. You're done. There's no long-term obligation there. The landlord isn't coming after you unless you break a lease, right? I'm talking about a month-to-month rent right now. If you know, you're done. But if you're in a house and you can't afford that payment because something changes, now you're looking at foreclosure, legal costs, all of that. Mm-hmm. So you might say, well, I'm going to sell my house. Well, that might be a solution. But what if the market has declined mm-hmm. and you can't get as much money out of your house as you just paid for it a year, 2 years, 3 years ago? That's when there's a real problem. So I like there to be some wiggle room. I do approve, if I can use that word, of owning homes, right? Mm-hmm. I think you do build equity. I think you do have some security, but they also come with some expenses that you aren't considering in rent, such as taxes, real estate taxes, mm-hmm. and repairs, yeah. and homeowners insurance. So, you know, very often people do that sort of simple comparison. I'm paying this in rent. I could be paying that in a mortgage.
Right.
You could, but you might also have to consider those other expenses I'm talking about. Now, if she could wait a little bit until housing prices decline, and they will, they'll go down again, right? If she can wait till housing prices drop and tolerate her rent for the moment, then she could trade in her high rent for possibly an equal or lower mortgage mm-hmm. and use that to her advantage. Yeah, but in the meantime, is she throwing money out the window? Yeah, well.
Yeah, I always hear that term too. And I think that on the flip side, people feel like even with the repairs and the taxes and all that, at least you own something at the end of it versus not owning anything. But I guess it just depends what situation you're in, whether it's worth it or not.
And if you can pay for it.
Right.
You know, sometimes people get into these homes because they look good on paper right then and there. Mm-hmm. And sometimes people even do that intentionally. Look, we both have great jobs right now. We're planning to change our jobs. We're going to make less money. Let's get that mortgage now while we can qualify.
Right.
What are you qualifying for? You're qualifying to be in over your head when you change your jobs, mm-hmm. you know? So be conservative when you're trying to get a mortgage, because I promise you, mortgages are long-term, you know, 20, 30 years for most people. With us, you know, they're usually about 8 or 9 years when we add in all their debt and pay it off, which it tends to change those decisions for the positive. But, you know, be conservative, because there will come a time when money gets tighter for some reason, and you need to be able to survive that. So in addition to getting a mortgage that you can afford, certainly build up cash reserves, as I think it was Erica that asked about the $1,000. Mm-hmm. Certainly build up cash reserves so that you can tolerate those kinds of expenses and surprises, and expect real estate taxes to continue to go up.
All right, let's get your phone number for anyone that's got specific questions.
Thank you. It's 413-773-3333.
And you can always go to info@hugyourmoney.com. We'll be back next week with another edition of Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Frances Rand.
Have you heard about Get the Tea? It's an online herbal supplement company with high quality standards. You cannot find these in stores. They carry cleansing teas and targeted herbal supplements for all your health needs. Go to getthetea.com today to order yours. Health shouldn't be put off. It should be a priority. And check out their specials page for sale items. That's getthetea.com. Enter code TEA123 for 10% off exclusively for my listeners. Getthetea.com, code TEA123. Order today. This is Frances Rayum, the Money Doctor. Now you can become 100% debt-free, budget successfully, and retire well, all under the Hug Your Money umbrella.
Like, I think back on it, and I think we have refinanced our house a lot of times. You know, we bought our house in 1988, and it's always been equity, roll it all in, kids' college, roll it all in. This is the selling point of it. Right now you're paying $1,000 a month just for your mortgage alone. If you roll it all in together, you're only going to be paying $700. And it's everything's all paid. And then we say, oh, we're going to pay extra on that. Oh, yeah. We're going to still pay $1,000 even though we only owe $700. We don't.
Debt, budget, retirement. Hug works best when we work together. Schedule your free consultation with a Hug Your Money coach today. Visit HugYourMoney.com. Hug Your Money. So unique, it's patented.